Nivar by Werewolves Are Real. Read by Petica. Summary. Humans have demons. Vulcans have Khatras. Spock, born of both, has neither. Which he's fine with, really. Meanwhile, James Kirk is a little curious about the whole demon business, because how the hell can he have two souls? Author's note. For those unfamiliar with the His Dark Materials trilogy, demons are essentially external souls in the shape of an animal. Children's demons can shapeshift, but settle sometime around puberty into a final form. If a human dies, so does the demon, and vice versa. Other races/universes have different forms which their souls take, so demons are not necessarily found in all races in the same form. Severing refers to cutting the bond between human and demon, which sometimes leaves them alive but reduces the two to virtual zombies. Demons are typically the opposite gender, but not always. Having a demon of the same sex is implied to be loosely connected to homosexuality. Demons can talk, and their actions typically represent what their person is feeling. It is extraordinarily rude to touch another person's demon. It typically only occurs between couples, and even then in rare and special relationships. First contact is always frightening. No matter how kind or open the species, a race's first encounter with alien life always carries a subtle fear of, what if? That fear typically fades into excitement eventually. Unless the contacting race is, say, the Klingons, in which case there's just more fear. But initial judgments can still taint relations forever. When the Vulcans first made contact with Earth, people were surprised at how normal they appeared, how similar to humans. Oh, they might bleed green and have pointy ears and funny eyebrows, but overall, they looked as though they could have been a race of mildly disfigured people. In that regard, they were actually quite non-threatening. But their lack of demons was terrifying. Soulless monsters, people whispered. Abominations. And then the humans learned that they were the only race to have animal-like companions from birth. And that fact became fuel for the ugliest supremacist groups of the era. Other races had no demons, after all. So didn't that set humans apart? Didn't it prove, irrevocably, that they were the only race with souls? Not really. Vulcans, it was explained, had Khatras. They keep their demons on the inside, as humans put it. And this fact was greeted with suspicion, but eventually accepted. After all, the Vulcans didn't act like they were severed, cold as they were. They had to have a demon somewhere. Other races have their demons in different forms. When Andorians are born, shards of something firm and strong and ice-like spring around their necks. And it grows with every child until taking a final unique configuration at adulthood. Tellarites make theirs. Strangely delicate chains pounded into shapes to fit around their arms like bracelets. Kashian kits pounced upon their shiny, glittering stones within a week of birth, which unnerves some other races, because what if they don't find the stone? But that just makes the Kashians laugh, because that, after all, would just be impossible. So one day, far after Earth's first contact, there is a sort of anxious tension as a mixed family wonders what form their son's soul will take. He will be born on Vulcan, the son of both that reserved race and the lively Terrans with the most animated soul form in the galaxy. Amanda Grayson's owl demon, Pianessen, excitedly picks out names, even as Amanda herself denies caring if her son will take after his human blood, because of course she will love him either way. It is illogical to lie, Sarek chides his wife. Amanda ignores him for a week. When Spock is born, he looks like a perfectly healthy baby by either Vulcan or human standards, though the latter might fuss over his greenish pallor a bit. Except for one thing, he has no demon. Amanda hides her disappointment well. Pionessen sulks. And Sarek, unmoved, steps back to allow the curious mind healers to check that Spock's Katra is normal. Though without a demon, it seems obvious. Right until a healer says, "There is nothing, Ambassador." Sarek goes very, very still. "What?" Amanda asks, wide-eyed. "What? You can't mean..." "He has no Katra." There's a panic, briefly. Pionessen tears up the room, because there must be a demon somewhere. But he can't find it. The mind healers check again and again. But there can be no mistake. Spock, by all accounts, has no soul. Winona Kirk, like every human, is intimately familiar with her demon. It would be hard not to be. She knows every stripe on Norden's tabby cat fur, every fleck of brown in his amber dark eyes. So it's understandable that she is rather alarmed to find something attached to her demon. "What on earth is that?" she exclaims, bending down and reaching for Norden. The next second, she jumps back, shocked, as Norden hisses and scrambles away. Winona is dumbfounded. On the other side of their quiet living room, George Kirk pauses to blink at her over a datapad. "Win, something wrong?"
He hissed. What is that?"
George frowns, blinking tiredly. He is on shore leave as of that very day, and more in the mood for sleep than worrying about an irritable demon. But he stands up anyway. "Kalen, talk to him, will you?" His mastiff demon pads over to the cat, who arches his back.
"You can't have it," Norden hisses preemptively. "It's not for you."
Kalen blinks, hurt. "What?" she asks. Norden twists cautiously and shows them. "It looks like a cocoon," George says slowly.
"Not yours," Norden mutters darkly.
"Dear, why do you have it?" Winona asks. His tail flicks an agitated motion. "It will be needed," is all he says. "Not now. I don't know. But it's not yours or mine. And you can't have it, okay?" "Of course, sweetie," Winona agrees. Agrees because she has to. Something is twisting inside her, dark and writhing at the thought of hurting that little green mass stuck to Norden's fur. And suddenly, she knows exactly what her demon means. No one will hurt it.
"When?"
George asks warily. She sits down, slowly. "Don't worry, George." She stares at Norden for a long while. "This is not bad. I don't know what's going on, but it's very, very much not bad." Spock grows up a perfectly normal Vulcan. Except, of course, for the fact that he is lacking a Katra. It isn't something that can be sensed outside melds. Only his parents know, and the intrigued specialists they visit again and again. "Fascinating," they say. "Revolutionary." Papers are written, theories fly about, but no answers. And Spock is, by all accounts, healthy, so eventually the visits stop altogether.
Spock sort of envies his mother, though that is un-Vulcan and very unacceptable. But he can't help it. He's read about human demons, wondering how he can lack both that and a Katra. And secretly, he has always preferred the idea of the demon. An unconditional love from another part of yourself. A lifetime companion who never leaves. The mere thought makes something in his chest ache, empty and hollow and grieving. And sometimes he irrationally hates his father, just for being Vulcan. But he tries to be a good Vulcan despite all that, because he can never be a human, but he can pretend at having a Katra at least. And pretend he does. And if his peers are barely civil at best, and typically condescending and disdainful and cruel, well, he's working on that.
It's a boy!
The nurse's exclamation is drowned out by George Kirk's shout of triumph. Winona, tired and a little irritated, smacks his arm hard.
Never again, she hisses.
What should we name him? Ignored by the two adults, a very similar conversation is taking place just feet away. A squalling tabby kitten appears from nowhere at all, dropped and formed in a cloud of gold dust that dissipates in a fraction of a second. It mews a loud, pained cry, then shifts abruptly to a mastiff puppy. It's whining in confusion. It morphs again, switch, 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 squirming the whole time.
You're not allowed to name things, Kaelin says firmly. You and Winona are both horrible with names. No.
I think Felicane Bouchard Nezard is a great name. Do you want the baby to be able to pronounce it? Ever?
Norden grumbles. Kaelin stares down at the kitten. It's calming now, blinking slowly to show dark amber eyes. The tiny demon meows pitifully, waving a pink paw and gazing up at them imploringly.
I think, she decides slowly, we should name her Telissa.
The kitten blinks once, and Norden melts. Okay. A nurse with plastic gloves carefully picks up the kitten minutes later, and it wriggles in her grasp. She sets it down gently on James Kirk's stomach, and it quiets immediately. The baby is being wheeled out in a see-through cribbing. George and Winona are whispering quietly, stars in their eyes. And the two demons pad over with satisfaction and delight. All is well. No one, however, notices the broken green strands on Norden's fur. The tiny silver butterfly that fell from it quietly alights on a kitten's paw, settles down, and sleeps. Time passes. When he is 7 and the Caswan is passed, Spock gains some new recognition from his peers. Maybe he is not so human, they murmur. And if some quietly point out that his lack of a demon proves that he is more Vulcan, well, he will hardly be the one to correct them. Then, to Pring. She is small and slight, but beautiful, a true Vulcan princess, the heiress of one of the noble clans, and everything a proper Vulcan mate should be. He is tight with excitement the day they gather on the sand-swept ceremonial grounds, T'Pau standing gravely between them, but forces back the emotion and tells himself that it is quite logical to speculate as to the character of his mate, so as to plan for the future, and that is all he is feeling. Their minds have been confirmed as compatible by healers, so the linking should be swift. Spock feels T'Pau's mind as a gentle torrent, grasping him with efficient delicacy and pulling his mind out, stretching it to grasp T'Pring's sweet prickly Katra. Something snaps. When Spock comes to awareness, he is flat on his back, gasping for breath, through sand-gritty eyes, dazed and pained and numb. He rises slowly to his feet, stumbling, and finds T'Pring glowering at him.
"Bathpake for a casht," she spits. "Cleefa!"
She stalks off the ground, 7 years old, with all the dignity of a Vulcan queen. T'Pau looks at him, appraising him a long moment, and then she too averts her eyes. Spock has never been so alone. It takes the Kirks almost a week to notice James's second demon. While the human newborn can't move much, his kitten or puppy-shaped demon flits around him excitedly, never straying more than a meter or two away. With all the movement, Winona only notices something odd when she stands watching James nap one morning, his demon curled up against his side, except... She blinks, leans forward. The creature is a mass of orange-striped fur, but does it have heads on both sides? "George!" she shrieks. The baby wakes, crying and wailing, and her husband practically flies through the door. Winona is stuck, staring in horror at the two identical kittens staring up at her and wailing pitifully. Then they change to twin puppies, and then a pair of silver butterflies, and she understands. Oh! Winona is suddenly sure that the second demon, whichever it is perfectly harmless. Not that it stops George from panicking.
"Win, I think I'm seeing double."
"No, dear, there's just two of them."
"Oh." A pause. "Why does my son have two demons?"
They set up a meeting with the demon researcher. Discreetly, because Lord knows old Miss Taft down the street would call the global news station in a heartbeat if she got wind of this. And the man insists on meeting at their house. "The natural environment," he says.
"You say only one was born with him?"
asks Thomas Fleming, PhD, peering down at the now squirrel and kitten pair thoughtfully.
"Yes, Telissa." "And is Telissa a girl?"
"Of course she is," George replies, surprised. "I mean, a boy's demon is always a girl."
"Not always. And one of these is male."
"So that must not be his."
"Well, it's really impossible to say. Same-sex demons are rare, but they are found. Did you check at the hospital?"
"Who would think to do that?" Winona snaps. She's uneasy with this clinical man prodding at her son's demon. Demons. Even if he is wearing gloves. The puppy snaps at him lazily.
"Exactly, exactly. No way of knowing." A sigh. But they both seem to respond to his emotional state fairly well. "And they don't stray?"
"Of course not."
"Well, then your son simply has two demons." The man shrugs. "Not something I've ever heard of, but it doesn't appear harmful."
"It's not natural," George Kirk insists.
"Doctor," Winona prompts, "before James was born, for a few years my Norden had this cocoon stuck to his fur. It went away right after the birth, and they both love turning into butterflies." Fleming shows his first sign of interest.
"Really? Now that... that reminds me of something, some old story. I'll have to get back to you. Was it a Chinese tale?"
"It is a Chinese tale.
It's a story about a peasant boy and a princess, to be precise. The princess is born as her father's only child, his only heir, and yet she is born, appallingly, without a demon. She is shunned by the community, spurned as a hell-sent monster, and exiled from her people. She lives secluded in a dark forest, harmless and lonely. But nearby, villages whisper of an evil, soulless witch who seeks only to steal the demons of others, to devour them and state a longing for what she once possessed. But stories, even bad ones, mutate with distance, and so a young peasant leagues away, instead hears the more accurate story of a beautiful girl bewitched to a life of loneliness, bereft of a soul, born demonless. And this peasant boy is mesmerized for a different reason. He has two demons. He steals from his village that very night, trekking across the country in search of the beautiful girl. When he arrives at the village outside her forest, he is warned away fiercely, for the villagers are sure that his extra demon will make him irresistible to the bitter witch. But he goes anyway. No one knows what happens in the forest, but the boy and girl walk out hand in hand the next day with two newly settled demons, a lion and a red-crowned crane, both sacred to the Chinese, and they mix with their two humans so often that no one is sure which demon belongs to whom. The princess returns to her lonely father, and the nation rejoices in their newfound dynasty, surely blessed by the gods. And the crane and lion watch over the land for half a century before dying happily together. It's a nice story, a romance, a fairy tale. But of course, quite impossible. After all, no one could survive as long as the princess did without a demon. What tentative acceptance Vulcan had possessed for Spock is gone. They say he is an evil abomination, a Shaka come to haunt them and steal their Katras away, eating them to replace his own lack. His classmates, always distant, cringe away and stare at him as something that is no longer a failed experiment, but a crime against nature. He has no soul, is doomed to die a true death, but more than that, he is unnatural. Life without a Katra, true life, is scientifically proven to be impossible, and yet, paradoxically, he exists. Spock spends much of his time reading Earth novels in his younger years. They are full, of course, of demon characters and references. How could they be otherwise? The books hint at a closeness, a partnership, an unconditional companionship, and something the humans call love. Alone on a planet of 14 billion, something tiny and repressed aches for that companionship. He reads anecdotes of severed humans who grieve for lost demons, fading slowly into an agonizing death, an end that is considered a merciful blessing, a relief, freedom. There is much Spock does not understand about humans, but he can understand that. It takes Jim a long time to realize that he is unique. He has two demons from birth, after all. But everyone else in the family, his mother and father and Sam, only have one each. This confuses him, because who wouldn't want two demons? When he asks his mother why he has both Telesa and the male demon known as Septon, she puts aside her work and takes them. Jim and his curious demons into his bedroom, sitting down on his star-covered quilt and gesturing for Jim to take a seat beside her. No one else I've ever met has two demons, Jimmy, but some people... She neglects to mention that some people refers only to one eccentric scientist-theologist. Think that it means one of your demons is for, well, your soulmate, some poor girl missing her demon. And one day you'll meet her.
Jim is horrified. "She won't take them, will she?" he cries, unable to imagine anything worse.
"No," Winona hastens to assure. "In the story, it's like you'll be so close, you'll both share your demons together, and you'll have a connection to that person, Jim. True love."
"But girls are weird." "Is Telesa weird? Your connection to this person, I bet it's similar to the one you have with Telesa and Septon, if you're as close as the stories say."
Jim brightens. Like all children, he has a little greed in him.
"Like having three demons."
"Better," Winona compromises, and decides not to explain that, no, it's not the same thing at all. Every night thereafter, Winona recites the story of the princess and the peasant boy to get Jim used to the idea. And Jim, fledgling romantic that he is, latches on to the story eagerly. His demons are a little more doubtful.
"I'm not leaving you, ever, even if you will be around this other human a lot," Telesa declares stoutly, and snuggles closer to Jim as a clinging sloth. Septon, today a robin, ruffles his feathers in a dignified manner.
"Logically, if one of us is indeed bound to this other human, we would be very pleased to go with him after the meeting."
Septon seemed to go with all of Jim's moods when they were young, but now he fluctuates between cool, reserved rationality and occasional random outbursts of temper. Or, more distressingly, distress and sorrow. Sam says that Septon is something called bipolar, and that it means Jim is a little crazy deep down. But Jim finds it endearing. Telesa glowers at the bird.
"Do you want to leave?"
More feathers rustle.
"I am merely making a point," Septon says.
He hops forward, landing on Jim's arm and tightening his grip until Jim winces. He adds with quiet, restrained relief,
"But we do not need to be concerned with that for a long while."
Cybok doesn't taunt Spock. Cybok seems to sympathize, but he never treats Spock like something sub-Vulcan for locking a Katra. Even so, it doesn't diminish Spock's secret envy. He tries to reject the emotion for a time, but Cybok will not judge him for a lack of control. And in any case, the point is moot. Their arms brush one day while Cybok lectures Spock on physics, and the full Vulcan goes very still. Spock's mind had been drifting, as it was wont, onto the subject of demons and Katras. He lowers his head in shame when he notices his half-brother's stare.
"I apologize, Cybok. It is poor of me to hold envy."
"Do you want to know what it's like?" Cybok blurts. Spock blinks, startled and unsure what his brother means. Then Cybok lifts a hand to Spock's face.
"May I?"
Slowly, Spock nods. Cybok draws him in. It's not the first time they've melded. It will not be the last. But this is different, both wonderful and terrifying, because Cybok is dragging him past thoughts and emotions and behind memory and behind the physical realms, dragging him to some secret inner place that pulses and pounds with life and energy and everything that makes up Cybok. It's writhing and twisting and sparking, dark and light and glittering rays of refracted gold dust, twined in pulsing cords with hazy edges that drift into unimaginable oblivion. It feels of Cybok, is Cybok, and suddenly Spock knows precisely what he is missing when teachers say to center yourself, find yourself. Because how could Spock know himself without this? It is not a perfect vision. There are dents and wounds and rents in the Katra, and some go so deep
then another Vulcan, knowing better, would recoil from this already damaged man. But Spock is not normal, because he has no Katra, and the sight is beautiful. He feels grateful and honored and awed. He is also resentful. He finds suddenly that the envy has not faded, and now, more than ever, he hates Cybok with an unprecedented passion, loathes him for showing this tempting, forbidden thing, and he withdraws from the meld ruthlessly. Cybok winces at the abruptness of the separation. For his part, Spock turns away, closing his eyes and breathing deeply. The simple exercise doesn't hide the shaking of his body, the silent jerking of his shoulders, and he clenches his fist tight enough that his nails draw blood. He is Vulcan. He may not have a Katra, but he will have control. He is Vulcan. He is. "I'm sorry, Spock," Cybok cries, and ignores every tenet of Vulcan culture to embrace him from behind. "I'm sorry, I'm sorry." Somewhere on Earth, a confused Jim Kirk consoles his suddenly sobbing demon, the other fluttering around nervously. Spock suddenly feels much better, and he is very glad to have Cybok. The other kids at school stare at Jim a lot. It's not too bad, because everyone knows it's exceptionally rude to directly inquire about another's demons. But demons themselves talk together all the time. "You can't both be his demon," a nosy woodpecker insists, twitching his head at Telesa and Septon. "We are," Telesa snaps. She's a grass snake today, and hisses each word like a curse. Jim is tense at his desk, likewise agitated, sneaking narrow-eyed suspicious glances at the other six-year-old sitting by him that keeps accidentally kicking his chair. "You're just jealous that you're alone." The woodpecker bristles. "I am not. I have Tessa." "You only have Tessa," Septon corrects snidely. He's a tiny gecko, clinging to Telesa's scales. "There's three of us. I have a human and a demon companion, and so does Telesa." He raises his head, waving it in an arrogant motion. Jealousy is a natural response. The woodpecker flaps its wings, agitated. At the desks, his human kicks Jim's desk loud enough that a loud thunk booms out. Jim turns around to glare, and the girl gives him a dirty look. "You're not even natural," the bird squawks. "A male demon for a boy? You're a fake, is what you are. I bet you could die and he wouldn't even care." And Septon, unpredictable as always, suddenly morphs into a kitten, and he's crying. Not with tears, but with terrible, heart-wrenching yowls and whines, high-pitched and desperate. It's a little bizarre, because Jim looks irritated, but not really upset. So the woodpecker just stares. But Telesa is furious. She changes into another cat, lunges at the snotty bird with outstretched claws. Both boy and girl cry out at their desk as the two demons go down in a swirl of feathers and fur, both shifting through shapes as quickly as possible. The teacher finally sees what's going on and separates the two. Afterward, Jim takes her rebuke humbly enough, stroking poor Septon kindly, but he's trying not to grin. Even through the pain of an injured demon, one couldn't help but notice that Telesa's shifting had been much more creative than the woodpecker's. Spock has always been rather fascinated with Pianessen. His father disapproves of any tactile contact for his son, so Spock was essentially banned from physical contact with his mother after the age of 3. But touching animals is something entirely different, and Sarek has never even bothered to stop Spock from touching his mother's demon. It's incredibly rare to do so, of course, but something about the owl is just fascinating. Pianessen is a small, tawny owl, striped with brown and gray. Spock has researched the species. They are known for being typically silent, but can be swiftly efficient predators when aroused. They will willingly die in defense of a nest, and sometimes even attack humans. Spock wonders if Sarek is aware of this fact, and whether or not it contributes to his silence on the matter. Amanda practically beams every time he strokes Pianessen, and the feeling, the strange, indescribable warmth that shudders through him, is indeed very pleasant. Pianessen adores him as well, of course, happily alighting on his shoulder to murmur in his ear after a long day. It doesn't help any with Spock's issue of envy, but he can ignore that when it comes from his mother. But one day, being a curious 8-year-old Vulcan, he decides to try and meld with Pianessen. Spock has melded with every member of his family. Amanda adores meld and happily volunteered again and again when he sought to master the skill. And of course, he has melded with animals. That occurs long before sapien species melding. But what, he wonders, would melding with a sentient animal be like? Pianessen is curious too, when Spock presents the idea. They don't bother asking Amanda. It turns out to be a poor choice. Pianessen's mind is even brighter than the Katra of Cybok, and shockingly intelligent. Every fabric, every scrap of his being is interwoven with Amanda. A thick band stretches between them, a tie that makes Vulcan marriage bonds weak and frivolous. He and Amanda are separate and one. They gain their strength from another, their will. And Pianessen plays off her emotions and is her emotion. And it is so delicious and complex and bright that Spock burrows in deeper, deeper, deeper. He is pulled from Pianessen's mind with painful force and looks up dazedly into his father's face. For once, the full Vulcan's dark eyes shimmer with barely controlled rage, and the hand gripping Spock's arm feels ready to snap him in half. In the background, there is screaming. Amanda is rushed to a hospital, but she recovers, curling around her shell-shocked demon the whole while as her mind slowly returns. Within the week, she is back home, and she gives a weak, kind smile every time Spock apologizes. "I know, Spock. I understand you were just curious. You couldn't have known, so don't blame yourself. I'm not angry." She doesn't seem angry. She smiles at Spock and touches his hair when she walks by, and still grows righteously protective over him, and everything seems perfectly normal. But Pianessen stops landing on Spock's shoulder. He stops speaking to Spock entirely, in fact. And though Spock doesn't realize it yet, he'll never touch the owl demon again. Jim is 12 when he first kisses a girl. It's a shy kiss, a childish kiss, a hasty impulse after a day running around the summer carnival. Sandy smells like strawberries, and their quick, blushing peck leaves behind the taste of cotton candy. She giggles helplessly when they part, apparently shocked at her own audacity. Her pretty squirrel demon, already settled, flicks his tail around Talessa, teasingly. He ignores Septon entirely. She and Jim walk to her home through the quiet evening light, arms swinging blithely alongside Iowan cornfields and placid ponds. When she's safely home, Jim makes for his own house, beaming at his demons.
She's great, isn't she?
Her demon has pretty fur, Talessa admires.
They haven't settled, and she's taken on a squirrel form herself in mimicry. Smaller, but with almost blackish fur. It shimmers in the dim light.
Like Sandy's hair, Jim says brightly, smiling with child happiness.
She is illogical, says Septon flatly. Her laughter is inane and irksome and typically unprovoked, and that squirrel has all the fake and unwarranted lasciviousness of a longtime catamite. She is prone to flits of whim, and her presence is not conducive to your emotional stability. It would be logical to desist in your relationship.
Logical. Illogical. He uses those words often these days, and his emotional outbursts are rare. His gravity disturbs Jim's family sometimes, but he doesn't understand why. Septon has plenty of emotions. He just doesn't show them. Although it is a little weird when he uses words Jim doesn't even know. Naturally, Jim takes Septon seriously.
Why?
Even so, he's somewhat put out. Trying to parse through Septon's odd explanation, he turns to Talessa. What was wrong with her? Talessa sobers a little. I don't think her demon likes Septon very much. Jim looks momentarily stricken. Then his face hardens.
Well, whatever, he says.
He waves at Septon. The demon hesitates, then leaps onto Jim's hand as a rabbit. Talessa scurries up Jim's shoulder. Sandy's stupid anyway. She hates Starfleet, you know. Wants to stay in Iowa forever. Jim's scoff gives his opinion of that. We should ask out Laura. Her demon's a fox. Jim waggles his eyebrow. Everybody wants to date someone with a fox demon. Talessa blinks at him.
Why?
John tilts his head, frowning.
I'm not sure.
Spock is 15 when he starts to seriously consider his future. His peers do not mock him openly anymore. It would be petty, and it would indicate harsh feelings, which the others think to be beneath them. But he is still shunned, openly and without care, because they all know that he is empty inside. He thinks the whole planet knows by now. Sarek's son, the half-breed with no Katra. And then Cybok, for lack of a better word, goes mad. It starts slow, religious ramblings. I have these dreams, he confesses to Spock. Cybok is odd, having never quite accepted the Serakian disciplines, and doesn't even bother to hide his emotions around Spock. Spock, there's a god, I'm sure of it. One god, and he's calling to me.
You are certain? Asks Spock diplomatically.
In the spirit of IDIC, he would never denigrate the religion of another. He still sometimes prays to the old gods himself, though many modern Vulcans dismiss them as myth.
I feel it, Cybok confirms fervently.
Spock rolls his shoulders uneasily at the casual use of that word, but says nothing.
He's calling me, and I have to serve him.
To Spock's surprise, Cybok manages to seek out other believers. They are all searching for this god, Cybok tells him, and the paradise land in which he lives. Cybok calls it Shakari. He says the humans call it Eden, the Romulans Vortator, the Klingons Quitu. But it is all the same. Spock accompanies Cybok to meetings sometimes, clandestine visits to a nearby starbase that is just hours away by shuttle. where clashing groups of Andorians and humans and Cadians and other less well-known races discuss their faith. Though he never pledges to their religion, the members seem to see Cybok as their leader and welcome Spock warmly, soul or no. The meetings also seem to focus as much on Chakari as on criticizing Herberts, supposedly ignorant heretics. But Spock decides not to point this out to his brother. The encounter is, in many ways, a new experience. Cybok's belief is so strong, so fervent, and the allure of such a comforting faith is tempting. Spock begins, tentatively, to speak up at the meetings, ask question after question, and for the first time starts to doubt logic. Spock wonders if, should such a heaven hypothetically be found, this god of Cybok could explain his lack of Katra. Maybe even give him one. And then, horror, Vulcans start to join the group, but it's quickly discovered by the appalled public that they are not doing so willingly. Cybok has used his prodigal psychic gifts to mutilate his followers' thoughts, bending them to his will. Cybok is considered too dangerous to arrest or keep on Vulcan. In a typical gesture, the planet banishes him and pretends the problem never happened. All the members of Cybok's group, now branded a cult, are required to attend sessions with mind healers to remove every trace of Cybok's telepathic touch from their psyche. Spock is suddenly glad that Cybok is family, that Cybok has melded with him since childhood, and the healer is destroying Cybok's mark indiscriminately. It prevents anyone from discovering that he has not melded with Cybok for over 2 years. His sense of belonging is gone. It never existed, Spock realizes. It was a lie, a falsehood perpetrated by his psychotic brother. He fits nowhere, nowhere on Vulcan in any case. He wonders if Earth might be different. Jim's first month on Tarsis IV are some of the happiest of his life. The time is laborious and challenging because the colonists are eking out a rough substance-based living on a raw world. But the sheer rural charm of the place endears it to him. No sprinkler systems or automatic pickers on these farms. In the same fashion that Jim loves bona fide paper books, the place just draws him in. Telessa and Septon love it too. They still haven't settled, which is weird for a boy of 14, but he doesn't mind. They pull equipment as tiny horse or oxen, or turn into brightly colored chickadee birds and swoop in to steal seeds from farmers who laugh as much as they curse them. Jim works during the day, and some evenings he slips over to the neighbor's house to speak to a woman there, a retired Starfleet veteran. It's Hoshi Sato, crooked and ancient, but still capable of smiling. She was a member of the original NX Enterprise, the first Warp 5 vessel in the fleet, and that mission is still legendary. The old Asian woman greets him warmly at each visit, and she's taken to tutoring him in alien languages. She teaches him a little Zindi reptilian, possibly just to see him struggle and laugh. He starts to suspect suspiciously, as well as Orion, Dalton, and Andorian. Not much, of course, just some useful phrases, fun facts. She teaches him Vulcan, too. She always has a grin on her face when she talks about Vulcan. And to their shock, Septon seems to pick it up flawlessly. Jim is a genius by any standard, but when Septon starts reciting Vulcan poetry, she gets an odd look in her eye and won't stop laughing to explain. He likes that about her, too. Hoshi Sato never even asks about his two demons, and her own parrot demon is just as cheerful and interesting. Hoshi is amazing, Jim decides. And it's her lessons that decide his resolution. He's going to join the Enterprise crew when he's in the Starfleet. No, he's going to captain her. The kids are decent too, the excitement of living on an alien world distracts them from paying more than a token attention to the boy with two demons. And by the time that novelty starts to fade, everyone is well adjusted to him and largely disinterested. Jim's aunt and uncle are friends with the Riley family, and some evenings or nights, he forgoes Hoshi's lessons to play games with the lonely but energetic 9-year-old boy and his overactive demon, Persip. Kevin's demon is okay with Septon, too. Jim always checks now. Jim eventually hears word of a food shortage, something about a fungus, but the details are fuzzy, and he's not too concerned. His aunt starts locking the cabinets and smacks his hands when he tries to sneak a snack, and it's annoying to go through fields of rotted food looking for something salvageable. But his relatives are just upset the prices are hard. Which is bad, of course, but it's the 23rd century. It's not like they're going to starve. Spock enters Starfleet against his father's wishes. The conversation is not pleasant. You are committing yourself to a barbaric, outmoded organization dedicated to military efforts. Your heritage will not concern them. In Starfleet, you will be oath-bound to follow the orders of illogical, emotional beings with self-interest at heart. It is unfair to call non-Vulcans illogical, Father. I am not entirely Vulcan. I could never forget, is the cool rejoinder, and Spock manages not to flinch. You realize that it is almost inevitable you will be forced to kill? Some sects of Serakian philosophy recognize that the right to self-preservation trumps harm occurred on others. If you join Starfleet, Sarek interrupts quite rudely, you will be no son of mine. I would have that very clear. No argument will persuade me. If you leave, do not plan to return. Clear, direct, simple. Spock leaves. The human stare at his eyebrows, his ears, twitch when he fails to smile or laugh or frown or react as they expect. But there are other aliens on the San Francisco campus, if no Vulcans. So it is tolerable simply because they are not staring at his lack of demon or lack of Katra. As far as they know, he is perfectly normal. Your lives mean slow death to the more valued members of the colony. Therefore, I have no alternative but to sentence you to death. Your execution is so ordered. Signed, Kodos, Governor of Tarsus IV. The words ring in Jim's ear as he flees with Kevin. Talessa and Septon are a pair of panicked rabbits, bolting ahead of him as far as they can. Phaser fire screeches in the distance behind them. Seven others are running behind the pair, crying or gasping or holding a hand over their mouths to stifle their screams. They manage to escape the soldiers Kodos had unexpectedly sent to subdue 4,000. God, it was unimaginable to kill 4,000 members of the colony. Jim's aunt and uncle are dead. Hoshi Sato is dead. His mind touches the thought, rejects it, slides away. Not now. Not yet. He hears footsteps ahead, pounding steps. Left! Left! He hisses and veers. He hears their quiet steps trailing his turn. He's not sure how he's become the defunct leader of the 9 kids who somehow escaped, but he is, and he's a Starfleet officer. Or he will be anyway. So he's going to do this. He's going to help them, save them, even if he dies trying. They don't stop until nightfall, when the double moons of Tarsus are high in the sky. It's a clear night, and Jim's mind, in some absurd sadism, flickers back to a cheery sugar-sweet kiss under the neon flash of carnival lights. He feels like dropping to his knees and just screaming, but he can't. Kevin is clutching his arm and crying silently, in great kid hiccups, clutching his mouse-shaped demon to his heart like it's going to be torn from him. and not without reason. He shudders, remembering the oily dark flash of the soldier's touch on Septon and Talessa. No one should touch another person's demon, not like those soldiers did. It's a crime tantamount to rape to do so with malicious intent like that. And the soldiers hadn't even flinched to use their demons against them. But then, most decent people didn't go about committing genocide either. They might be lucky, though, in a way. The guards were using the demons as hostages, if brief ones. Maybe that's why only the kids survived. Talessa had twisted into a dog and bit down on her guard's snake demon, killing them both instantly. And Septon had followed suit, using the shape of a small lion to crunch a rooster between its slavering jaws. They look harmless enough now, meek and rubbing against Jim, running forward now and again to nuzzle Kevin. He sighs. Then he realizes the kids are all watching him. He's the oldest. They want orders. They're in a rocky, barren region a few miles out from the colony. It's uphill, and Jim can look down and watch the whole place from that rock. There's still the occasional flare of phaser fire against the dark night, flashing and vanishing. He looks away. We'll rest here, but we need to watch for any guards. I'll stay up first. Who's oldest? There's a 13-year-old, Thomas Lighton, and 2 12-year-old twins. The others huddle together to sleep. God, one girl is 5, as they decide watches. Should we try to light a fire? Thomas asks dubiously, glancing around them. There's a noticeable lack of trees on Tarsus. Jim has read enough adventure books to know the answer to this. No, that will give away our position. We need to keep still and quiet. We'll move before it's fully light out. They nod and disperse. While the others sleep, Jim stares hard at the colony, watching for any shadow of movement. Cunning Septon has shifted to a tawny owl and hovers watchfully over the camp, while Talessa shifts into a sleek panther, leaning against Jim to match his gaze into the distance. Her eyes glow gold in the starlight. "We'll save them, Jim," she whispers. "All of them." Spock's time at Starfleet Academy is not excessively challenging intellectually. He is admittedly on a much accelerated course and has already tested out of many required classes. He is aloof from other cadets, but that is not unexpected. And though his Vulcan ears might overhear the occasional specious slur, no one harasses him. He is largely content. But there is something strange. As a Vulcan, Spock has superior control of his body, as well as the signals he allows his brain to affect. Sensations like fatigue and hunger, for example, are easily dismissed. In any case, Spock should not be hungry. Starfleet Medical monitors the nutritional intake of cadets, and do not account for his difference of race. Spock eats more than is typical for him, certainly well within the requirements for a Vulcan of his metabolism. So he doesn't understand why he's starving all the time. Talessa has taken the form of a gray wolf, emaciated and covered with patched, matted fur. She hulks by Jim's side, as big as she can make herself, eyes roving over the landscape with blatant hostility. Jim knows she would never hurt him, but he shivers every time he sees her. Wolf demons are wrong. Wolf demons belong to sociopaths, murderers, the insane. Many wild creatures are found as demons, but something about wolves are just toxic. Looking at Talessa in this form only fills him with more despair. If he does survive this hell-forsaken planet, if they all survive, what will happen afterward? Will Talessa stay like this? Will he go mad? He can sense that she hasn't settled. Surely he would know if she had. But he doesn't say anything to her about the form either. He's heard that demon forms that kids reject the idea of are parts they reject in themselves. Often demons can turn into exactly the opposite of what you want. Demons don't settle to make their humans happy. They represent the human. Simple as that. And God, if the feral, starved hunger gleaming from Telesa's eyes isn't exactly perfect. Call it superstitious, but he isn't letting on to Telesa how much he hates the form. Sometimes Septon is a wolf too, even thinner and more feral, trotting a half step behind his sibling and snarling at anything that nears her. But he still holds that queerly bipolar quality, and at safer times he'll twitch into the form of a mouse, a rabbit, a cat, curling up around Jim or nosing at Kevin's persip mournfully. More disturbingly, though, Septim's bond is starting to stretch. Jim isn't sure what to make of that. He's only heard of stretched bonds in old stories about witches. But witches aren't real, and Jim sure isn't one. But one day, Septon morphs into a hawk, a dark creature with a wicked beak and far-seeing eyes, and flies up to scan the land around them. But he can't fly far enough, high enough, so he pulls on the bond until the stabbing pain of starvation that is Jim's constant shadow becomes consumed by the pain of separation. And he clutches Telesa's fur and grits his teeth and tries not to scream. It's easier now, frightfully easy. Septon can go at least a dozen yards away before their bond starts to twinge. Maybe it's Telesa's presence that makes it easier, but it still disturbs Jim that Septon can bear to leave him. He's never been normal, having two demons, but now Jim's certain that something is just plain wrong with him.
Spock collapses during his physics exam. It causes something of a panic. Humans are very emotional when confronted with things they do not understand, and no one knows why a seemingly healthy Vulcan would drop unconscious. Personally, he is more concerned with the concussion he gained hitting his head on the desk's corner, but no one else seems to mind that. Exhaustion, the Starfleet doctors say. Stress. A psychosomatic reaction.
No, Spock says. No. No, I am a Vulcan.
Malnutrition, they suggest.
He pauses.
Have you been eating well? Dr. Temple asks him. Her koala demon peers at him earnestly.
Yes, but...
He pauses.
What?
I have been... exceptionally hungry, despite my mental controls and the fact that I have increased my dietary intake. It is quite painful, constantly. Even when eating, I cannot account for it. The doctors hum and ah over him, taking blood samples and asking invasive questions, most of which, predictably, are answered with some variant of, "No, I am Vulcan." And postulate theory after groundless theory, and they all mean nothing. The hunger is constant, though he dutifully eats under their watchful eyes, and when they order him to eat until he feels full, he dutifully obeys until he is physically ill. A hybrid quirk, they ponder. Sometimes, with the worst of the hunger pangs, he feels a sweeping sense of desolation. A dark gloom pulling his mind into a ravaging darkness, threatening to tip him over the edge of sanity. He decides not to mention that. The doctors are right. It's probably just stress. Jim has been risking solo forays to the colony for a fortnight, just him and his demon while Thomas watches the camp. But he is coming back empty-handed,
and the supply rooms are crawling with Codis's soldiers. And now he is ill. Thomas wants to go, but Jim refuses. The 13-year-old is tall and gawky and too clumsy. His demon, like Kevin and his tiny white mouse, has settled due to the trauma of the massacre. Unfortunately, his has settled into a large gray tortoise, and Thomas might be able to hold him while running, but Jim really doubts their effectiveness as a stealth unit. But Jim is too weak to walk far, and from the black spots that swim into sight, he might faint halfway through the theft. He's been giving his share of the food to the younger children, who don't look too bad, but now he wonders if that decision has killed them all. Except, well, there's one possibility. Septon, you go. Septon quivers and turns into a mouse, gazing at him pitifully over quivering whiskers.
You can't, Talessa cries. He's been stretching the bond, but that's miles.
He has to, Talessa.
What if they get him?
Jim is quiet. What if no one goes? Talessa whines, leans back like she's going to howl, and thinks better of it. She nudges Septon sadly instead. The mouse stares and then abruptly shifts into a small goshawk. It is the only decision, he concedes in his reserved tenor. There is no trace of emotion in his voice, but Jim can see how his feathers tremble and twitch, and his heart clenches. But all he says is, go. And God, it hurts. Even worse than the hunger, the sickness, maybe even worse than watching the massacre. Septon goes the 90 meters they've managed the last fortnight, then beyond. It starts as a twinge, an ache, and then like a rusty nail twisting through his marrow, the pain stabs through his veins, his heart radiating and growing. Talessa is laying on top of him, whining and licking his face, but her face is dark and distorted. The kids whisper in the background, a dim babble of sound, and he can't even bring himself to care about them.
Come back,
he cries. But Septon doesn't. Maybe he can't hear, but even if he could, Jim later knows, he would recognize that Jim is speaking in delirium. There is no going back. It's an eternity in hell. He's senseless in minutes, just crying and writhing and babbling, and there's nothing but pain. God, why won't someone just kill him? Then, slowly, it recedes. A cloudy numbness replaces the ache, a feather-light euphoria, and he becomes aware that he's taking great, shuddering gasps, sweat-soaked. Someone has stuffed a gag in his mouth. Talessa is staring at him an inch from his face, and when he turns his head, he sees the younger kids staring at him a dozen paces away, wide-eyed and pale. Septon returns in seconds, and he's dragging a full bag of food. The children cheer raggedly. The bag drops carelessly amidst them, and then Septon plows into Jim and Talessa, curling against them in the biggest mastiff form he can manage. Jim slowly drifts asleep. It's nighttime when Spock is racked with pain. He has no roommate, necessary because of the climate-controlled desert heat of his quarters. But he quickly clamps his teeth shut over his pillowcase and has time to be grateful for this idea right before he starts screaming. When he fades back into dim awareness, every bone in his body is lax with fatigue. Over half an hour has passed, but Spock's guess would have been in days. He sits for a long while, just staring at the ceiling, then turns to gaze at the stars, glimmering through the coastal air outside the window. He gives a shuddering breath,
then rolls over resolutely. No one needs to know about this.
When the Starfleet officers come, Jim wants to hate them. They just look so appalled is the thing. They're shell-shocked just at the sight of the kids. "Try living it," Jim screams in his head. "There's children here, brave children who kept quiet and still and kept their heads and escaped, and they've seen more, done more than you ever will. So stop staring, just fucking stop and feed us already, you damn godforsaken sons of a..."
"We've come to rescue you," a red-shirted officer ventures tentatively. Jim can't help it. He starts to laugh. The two officers stare at him in astonishment. His kids are gathered behind him with all their demons. Telessa and Septon stare down the officers. 9 skeletal kids and 2 beefy adults, and they're saved, this guy says. And it's just the funniest thing Jim's ever heard. The other kids don't move behind him, don't react, because they know. They get what he's thinking, because they're right here. They've lived, and it's all over. And Kevin starts crying, first slowly, then with great hysterical sobs, clinging to his prematurely settled mouse demon with tight hands. Glaring daggers at the bewildered Starfleet officer, Telessa shifts from her aggressive wolf form, Septim stepping up to guard her, and snuffles over to Kevin. And Jim gasps, because this is it. This is it, her real form, his Telessa. And he stares at her in dumbfounded amazement as she looks at Kevin, and he clings to her gold-striped fur with frantic hands. She's a huge honey badger, with a dark, soft gaze. And he starts to smile through the tears prickling at his eyes. He falls to his knees and tells Septon to stand down. Everything is going to be just fine. The hunger and the crushing desolation that is its companion eventually ceases. Spock graduates among the top of his class, scoring high enough that he is immediately promoted to lieutenant, a rare honor. He is immediately assigned a premier posting, too. The flagship, the USS Enterprise. Captain Pike is purely professional with his crew, but impeccably polite, and he seems to be distantly fond of Spock. He never mocks him for the Vulcan's confusion over the behavior of his human crewmates, and has actually insisted that Spock come to him with his questions at any time. For the first time, someone outside the family has taken a special interest in Spock, and he treasures that acceptance. He will not abuse it. Jim's recovery isn't easy, but he has Telessa and Septon to aid him, so it isn't brutal. Telessa is content in her new form, and if he occasionally discovers that she's hoarded a little food under his bed, well, that's her quirk, not his, and it doesn't really mean anything. Septon doesn't settle, even when years pass and Jim signs up for Starfleet. That's okay, though. It was amazing when Telessa settled, but it's kind of useful to have a shifting demon along, too. From the speculative looks he gets at a Starfleet interview, others agree. Cadet Kirk, he likes it. Starfleet is a challenge, but he earnestly wants to succeed. He can never think of those officers on Tarsus without shaking his head. But he still wants to do that, to save people, to give them hope. And his gaze inevitably slides to Telessa, furry and content. He wants to do something with meaning. Gary Mitchell laughs at him, mocks his study habits. Kirk doesn't care. He studies every night and has Septon quiz him. And if that's a little weird, that his demon might have a better memory than him, anyone who protests can fuck off. It's not until Kirk's third year that he meets Leonard McCoy. He has a dislocated arm after physical training, and Leonard McCoy grumbles about inane injuries and idiot meatheads as he resets it. The random tirade sounds so ridiculous that the pain-delirious Kirk starts laughing. McCoy just scowls, which seems funnier. The sparrow-shaped septum flutters over to perch on Jim's head and blink at his shoulder, and McCoy stops, looks at him, looks at Telesa. Septum changes to a chinchilla, clings to Jim's scalp with wide eyes, and solemnly stares back. McCoy's confusion isn't helping Kirk calm down, but he smiles. "I have two demons," he explains. "Oh, yeah, I heard about you," McCoy murmurs faintly. "And they haven't even settled?" Septon's tail swishes. He hops down beside Kirk and turns into a Savannah cat, prim and straight, looking up at McCoy with faint disapproval. Telesa perks up. She knows lecture mode when she sees it. "It is illogical to assume that both of us are unsettled, simply because one of us is still capable of changing form. While my own shape fluctuates, Telesa has been settled for 5 years, 2 months, 1 week, 4 days, 8 hours, 57 minutes, and 28.9 seconds." A pause. McCoy gapes at him. "That is a very unattractive look," Septon adds. "The hell?" "Sorry, doctor," Kirk says, bubbling with mirth. "He can be a little mouthy." "I'll say." "He doesn't mean any harm," Telesa adds consolingly. A little mollified, "I like her better." Septon turns into a hedgehog and glares. "Personally, I'm fond of both," Kirk says brightly, testing his shoulder. "That one's just damn weird," McCoy mutters. "Unnatural." Kirk narrows his eyes, but a quick look to their demons makes him muffle a sudden laugh, his instinctive anger giving way to amusement. He grins at McCoy. "What you smiling about?" Kirk gestures. McCoy's porcupine is snuggling against Septon, who apparently took such an unprecedented shine to the creature as to mimic its form. They've both somehow huddled atop the back of Telesa in the past few seconds, and she blinks at the two humans smugly. "Screw you," says the man rudely. Kirk just laughs. Pike seems to have established himself as Spock's mentor as it is, and fully steps into the role when the unexpected death of the science officer leaves Spock to take the position. Spock takes the promotion with quiet efficiency, and Pike seems to find something special in him. "You have a real talent, Lieutenant. You need to work on your people skills, but you could go far." "It isn't that odd," Spock decides. "The captain has a close relationship with his first officer, known only as Number One, and she has an almost Vulcan stoicism about her. Logical, then, that the captain would socialize well with other like-minded individuals." Whatever Pike sees in him, the captain likes. He insists on dining with Spock once weekly in his private quarters to just talk, and seems to see the half-human as someone worthy of his sparsely given trust and confidence. Spock is honored to be given that trust, and he is pleased to find that he can relax, just somewhat, with this odd captain. He still keeps most of his past private, but he does talk about Cybok. It is oddly cathartic, and for the first time he understands the human method of dealing with problems. Instead of inward meditation, they seek sympathy and understanding through an outside perspective. Fascinating. One day as they dine, Pike strokes his bobcat demon, Bea, and eyes him thoughtfully. "I can't imagine what it would be like," he says suddenly, "to not have a demon." Lacking a frame of reference, that is understandable. What's it like to have a Katra? The man persists. Spock studiously examines his plate, uneasy. As I said, you lack a frame of reference. Pike rolled his eyes. Just try to explain, please. Even if it doesn't make sense to me, he smiles. Bea purrs, then rises to stretch languorously. He meanders over to twine around Spock's feet. It's a shocking trust, and every time Bea does it, he is reminded of Pianescent. I would not know. But, Pike blinks, but you don't have a demon. I do not. Then you have to have a Katra. You're half human and half Vulcan, right? That is correct. Then you must. I have neither. Pike stares at him for a long moment. Then he looks down at his own tray. Oh, he says. Bea walks away. Pike doesn't treat him any differently on the bridge. He still seems happy to answer Spock's human-related questions and stops him in the hall to tell wistful anecdotes of old missions. He seems very fond of Spock in his reserved way, but he never mentions what Spock admitted. But Spock can't help but notice that their weekly dinners stop about a month after his admission, abruptly after half a year of pattern. Well, he thinks, that friendship thing had at least been nice while it lasted.
I think Septon's lonely, Talessa declares one day. It's such an absurd statement that even Kirk has to stare at her.
He's a demon, Mitchell points out. How can he be lonely?
They're assigned to the USS Farragut. Kirk glances around, but he can't see Septon anywhere. Gary catches the look.
Good Lord, don't tell me he's not with you.
He does that sometimes.
It's weird.
Gary shudders a little, hugging his raccoon demon.
You have the strangest demons, Jim.
Talessa gives Gary a dirty look, then turns to Kirk.
Jim, I mean it.
He focuses on his bond to Septon, willing him to show up.
What makes you say that?
Talessa just gives him a piercing stare.
Don't play stupid, Jim. You know.
Kirk sighs. Yes, he does. Septon has always been a little reserved, but since joining the Farragut, he's been entirely taciturn, typically hiding in Kirk's cabin. He's gone so often, at least half the crew probably isn't even aware Kirk has a second demon. I know he's been a little down, but lonely is an odd choice of words.
Your demons are bizarre, Gary says again. You should know what each other are feeling, because you both feel it. How the heck could only one of you be lonely? How can you not know?
Shut up, Gary, he snaps. Come on, Talessa, where is he? They find Septon hiding in engineering as a muskrat, watching the frantic energy of the room with wide eyes. Kirk frowns at him.
What's wrong, Septon?
Septon eyes the engineers gloomily. That man is about to short-circuit his console. A second later, the console indeed starts to emit sparks, and curses rise over the din as a group of engineers descend on it.
Septon, why don't you join us anymore?
Septon is quiet a moment. It is not sufficient.
What isn't?
Any of it. All of it. His whiskers twitch. I am uncertain.
What can we do? Kirk insists.
Septon considers this, eyes following the other demons around the room, and finally decides, absolutely nothing.
Captain Pike is being promoted.
Number One is transferring, and Spock will become the new First Officer. It is a dizzying idea, and a distressing one. Spock could have served as Pike's first, he feels, but he somehow doubts his ability to establish a similar rapport with a new captain. James Kirk will be the youngest captain in the fleet, only 32. The man is supposed to be a genius, but he also has a reputation for impulsive decisions and a certain salaciousness of character. While most humans give him glowing reports, Spock cannot imagine serving well under such a supposedly emotive man. He considers transferring, but to where? A Vulcan ship, such as the Intrepid, would simply be a misery. Any human-dominated ship or base would likely carry the same problem as with Kirk. No, better to stay on the Enterprise, where he has worked for over a decade, and put up with the change as best he can. Doubtlessly, the experience will be trying, but Spock shall adapt. He, at least, can always be counted on to stay professional. Pike smiles politely as the silver-blue swirl of the transporter vanishes to reveal Commander Kirk, soon to be captain. He shakes the man's hand, noting the way Kirk's eyes dart around the transporter room and unable to really fault the other. One's first command is always exciting. He automatically looks to check the man's demon, wanting to assess this young captain, and he blinks. May I ask which one of these is yours, Commander? He asks uncertainly. Both, is the bright reply. A large badger peers up at him from the ground. A sleek black cat rests in the commander's arms, staring at the door. And then the cat is yowling, throwing itself forward and kicking its back paws at Kirk. The commander yelps, bewildered, and tightens his grasp instinctively. Septon? What are you doing? He's here! He's here! Let go! Let go! Even more bewildered by his demon's use of actual contractions, Kirk just gawks. At the transporter console, Lieutenant Commander Scott starts forward, worried. Suddenly the cat turns into a horse of all things, and Kirk pitches forward. As its feet hit the ground, it's a tiny hummingbird darting from his grip. The hell? Kirk gasps. The badger seems amused by the whole thing. The door slides open. Lieutenant Commander Spock steps through. He seems faintly bewildered, staring around vaguely. Curious, he murmurs. He blinks at the captain. I apologize, sir, but I thought... And a blue blur slams into him. Kirk clutches at his chest, gasping, and Pike stares. Spock, for his part, seems frozen, holding something tiny and blue in his hands, with the most unabashed show of awe Pike has ever seen on the man's face. You're mine, the bird says fervently. I think you broke your new first officer, Pike tells Kirk. The three have absconded to an empty room off the transporter area. Spock still seems uncharacteristically speechless, just staring at the tiny bird as it gazes right back. The badger is investigating the bird, too, which wouldn't be so weird if she weren't also leaning right against Spock as she does so. To his knowledge, Kirk and Spock have never even met. Why on earth would Kirk's demon be willing to touch the man? I've had two demons since I was born, Kirk explains. But Septon was always a little odd. He grins suddenly. He's a Vulcan. God, that explains so much. You have no idea. Vulcans don't have demons, contradicts the badger. Half Vulcan, Pike corrects distractedly. Oh, she settles, reassured. This is Telessa, Kirk adds absently. Septon, have you settled?
Yes, says the bird demon. He doesn't look away from Spock, so Pike is surprised when the Vulcan tears his gaze off his demon to talk. He is Alara, the Vulcan explains, with a shade of reverence in his tone. What are those like? Kirk probes gently. The Lara is a docile, shy bird in the wild, but not cowardly. When threatened, it imitates the shriek of La Metea to scare off predators, and it will defend its family and territory to the death when sufficiently provoked. He strokes the bird distantly, absently. I have a demon, he adds, a little lost. Mr. Spock, Kirk decides. I think we're going to get on very well. And they do. They eat every meal side by side, disappearing after shift for sparring matches or chess games, and the crew wonders at the odd pair. Between captain and commander, there is plenty of work, which should leave little room for a personal life. But on the bridge, they work in perfect tandem, perfect trust, and missions aren't so difficult as they should be. McCoy, when he comes aboard, is a little disgusted by the whole thing.
A Vulcan, he says. It figures.
Kirk would mind more if McCoy's porcupine demon, Ashadri, would stop cuddling with Septon. Spock is the first non-therapist that Kirk tells about Tarsus. Spock returns the trust by speaking about his disastrous meld with his mother's demon. But you can still meld with humans, right? Spock can, and he does. It's a dizzying experience. Spock warns him that the meld might be odd, nauseating. But instead, it's perfect. Something clicks together in their minds, like pieces of a puzzle, meshing together until even the ending of the meld leaves them linked and entwined, like one single individual. Tahila, Spock explains, stunned. Kirk doesn't ask for a translation. He doesn't need one. They have a dazzlingly blue desert bird and a stoic honey badger, both able to comfortably accompany either of them, and no one they meet is ever quite sure which demon belongs to whom. Spock and Kirk know, as do the Enterprise crew, but that's just a technicality. The four of them are, when it comes down to it, one and the same. The end. Reader's Notes. This was recorded for Duck Girly as part of ITPE 2018. I hope you enjoy it. I'd like to thank Werewolves Are Real for having blanket permission to record their fic. If you'd like to read it online, it can be found at archiveofourown.org/works/883088. If you'd like to download this podfic, it can be found at PetacaProductions.com. Thanks for listening.